Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining this, the latest episode of the Digital Trials Podcast. It is my honour today to introduce someone I've had the privilege of knowing, I'm going to say about 12, 15 years, someone who's been very well established in the industry and has now taken a very recent role, which we're going to discuss today, and that is Andy Cooper. So Andy, thank you for taking the time today, joining us here in fantastic Madrid. It's a little bit warm,
yes,
but it's been an enjoyable event so far. Before we get into why we're here and some of the other conversations, for those who may not be as familiar with you as I am, can I invite you to perhaps share a little bit about your background,
sure,
who you are, what you're doing?
Yes, absolutely. Thanks, Richard. So my name's Andy Cooper. So I'm the CEO at a company called Cluepoints, which is an expert in risk-based management and quality management systems. And we'll talk about that a little bit later, I'm sure. Prior to Cluepoints, I've been very heavily involved in the eCOA world at Clario, which was then previously ERT, led the commercial team there across the whole business, including medical imaging, cardiac safety, respiratory. So really heavily involved in some of those primary endpoint data capture solutions. Prior to that, when you and I got to meet each other, I was at Medidata for a number of years around EDC. And then before that was really 17 years at Oracle working around all the same systems, right? So around data management, EDC, CTMS, so drug safety, data warehousing. I got into this world, and we all have our story for how we got into this world. I did pharmacology at university, so I have this drive around drug development that started right at university, and then my other passion is software. And so being able to combine those two together, and what I'm now doing at Cluepoints is a lot of fun in that area.
So we're similar in that sense. I did biochemical sciences, and the number one takeaway from my degree is I never wanted to step in a lab ever again.
Yeah, we can share that.
It was use the science, but not really. So
yeah,
data management. So I fell into, not many of us grew up at six and said, I want to be a data manager.
No.
I definitely didn't. But you know what? It was the right fit, and I'm glad I did it. But today, let's talk about today. We're here in Madrid at the Viva Summit. Again, thank you for your time. You've had a chance to listen to a lot of updates. You've got a stand here as well, so you've been talking to a lot of people. I would like to get into today sort of debunking some of the myths, and specifically the myths around AI, machine learning, natural language programming, and perhaps putting into the context of data, patient journeys, user journeys as well.
Yeah.
So if I ask you, what does AI, ML, NLP mean to you?
It's a great question. I'm going to trigger you with your other one, because AI has this potential to be used in the way that DCT, your other favorite phrase, is also used. So actually, my 12-year-old had some homework from school where he had to define what artificial intelligence was. And actually, that was a trick homework, because there is no actual definition for artificial intelligence. If you think about the way that we interact with smart speakers at home, arguably that's artificial intelligence. You're talking to your phone, you talk to multiple different things. So when people use artificial intelligence, it's heavily overused in a very broad way. As an individual at Microsoft, one of the chief technology officers at Microsoft, Matt Veloso, who's very famous, he said, if it's written on a PowerPoint, it's probably AI. If it's written in Python, it's probably machine learning. And I think that's quite an interesting way of viewing the world. So to me, AI is a very broad term that covers all manner of things. Where it gets really interesting is you get into machine learning. And machine learning is then, how do you apply the algorithms to ultimately start to understand data in a programmatic way, find patterns that would be hard to find in other ways, and then use that to make decisions with. And there are a number of situations where we're starting to see that coming up. You know, as we think about the application of machine learning in our industry, we haven't really done a lot. I mean, I think you listen more broadly across the technology space and everybody's talking about it. And ChatGPT has obviously been the most famous, which is great. We can talk about that a little bit later. We've also played the ChatGPT at Cluepoints, tried throwing a bunch of clinical data at it, didn't do anything. So when you apply these mechanisms into clinical data, it is important to understand that the context of clinical data and what problem are we trying to solve? If you're not careful, it becomes a bit of a DCT term where everybody's just going to throw it around at everything and assume it's going to solve every problem. And it won't. You know, and I think there are different approaches between supervised and unsupervised approaches behind machine learning that, again, we can talk about where there are differences, right, in terms of how you approach things and what are you trying to get out of it. Be useful to go into supervised and unsupervised learning a little bit, just for fun?
I think you have it. Go for it.
Okay. So for those of you who don't know, supervised learning is ultimately you are labeling the data as it comes in. You're telling the algorithm, what is this thing? So a really basic example is if you've got film reviews coming in, and there's positive film reviews and negative film reviews, and you're telling the algorithm, this one's a positive one, this one's a negative one. It starts to understand what's written in that review and go, okay, I now got a pattern. This is positive, this is negative. It's highly accurate. It has a negative connotation about the fact that somebody has to teach it. So you have to label the incoming data. Unsupervised learning, there's no labeling. So the data just comes into the algorithm and the algorithm starts to find patterns and piece information together itself. The downside of that is it can take time to learn, whereas supervised learning happens faster. And the other downside is you can initially have a bit of noise. So you can get things that are coming up through the algorithm that look like they're interesting, and maybe they are, maybe they're not. And as time goes on, it learns more and the accuracy increases. And again, you know, we'll get onto it as well, but data anomaly detection, which is something we do in our industry, is a good example of where unsupervised learning can be very powerful if used properly. Because ultimately, one of the challenges you face in data management for many years is what could go wrong with the data? And people would sit there with data management plans. We would all do the same in our data management days. And you would write big, long data management plans about what am I going to check to ensure the validity of my data? And they can be long and exhaustive and write hundreds of edit checks. And you would spend a lot of time doing that. And are you absolutely certain you've got everything? Not sure. One thing we do know as an industry is we've ended up writing a lot of edit checks that never get used. And that's a waste of time and effort and money and resource. And so the question is, why are we doing it? Well, we do it for a safety blanket. So then if you're using something like an unsupervised machine learning to then look for what are potential data anomalies, that can become quite a powerful situation. And be able to find a way of reducing down how many different types of checks you have to write. What we found at CluePoints playing with unsupervised machine learning is, like I said, it requires lots of data and it requires a bit of time. We can speed that up. So the way of speeding that up is through self-supervised machine learning, another phrase, where the machine learning algorithm teaches itself. So as it starts to understand what's good and bad, or, you know, for the simple film review example, it will start to learn automatically. A good example of how self-supervised machine learning works is we've all got this sort of predictive text working on some emails and so forth. That is an example of how it's working. It's seen the pattern number of times and it's now starting to learn, okay, this is the way that it works. And so when I often write best towards the end of an email, the chances are the word regards with a comma after it and Andy is going to come soon after, because it's seen it a bunch of times, learned from it and gone, okay, here we go. But I think, again, as we explore the many different opportunities for machine learning in the industry, you know, we do need to be careful. I really want to make sure we don't make this another DCT umbrella where everything becomes tarred with this AI machine learning brush, even if it's just very basic edit checks.
I really like what you just said about Dan, is that using the data to pick on behaviors. And I think that's something that's going to become very important when we think about edit checks, my favorite topic, because it feels like we're writing edit checks that never fire, or fire but don't change the data. And actually, it's a very small percentage that actually fire and change critical data and so on. But that leads you to a question then, well, it could be that something doesn't fire is still ultra important, because if it ever does happen, we need to know about it. But does that open the door to, well, you have a data collection tool, whether it's EDCs or whatever it is, you have a data management tool, you have an analytics tool and a risk-based monitoring tool. So is it about picking where you expend the calories and where you put the effort in to match the reward to actually change behavior? Even down to, in your data collection tool, prevent something happening or predict if you do this, you're likely to do this. Is that where you think some of the intelligence will come in and potentially the cooperation and collaboration between different technology providers?
Yeah, I think the... Yeah, if I break your question down. So there's always going to be a place for edit checks. We know that, right? I mean, I think, again, if you've got a super important piece of data that you want to make sure is absolutely spot on, hoping and keeping your fingers crossed that a data anomaly machine learning algorithm is going to find it for you is risky. I would always say, I know I need to make sure this is right. Let me check that. Where we're getting a lot of value is the noise, right? Yep. So we're reducing out the noise of all the things that, it's amazing how many times edit checks fire erroneously. I mean, again, despite best intentions, they're not actually necessary. You know, the way that they're written looks right and it's been tested, but then occasionally it fires things up that the data manager looks at and goes, actually, I don't need to query this at all. So we can take that noise out of the equation, as well as also looking at what do we need to write and what do we not need to write. Then the next stage is, as the clinical knowledge grows in the algorithm, and there is undoubtedly the way that we've approached it, Clue Points, I mentioned before, we looked at machine learning, we took a bunch of clinical data, we threw it at ChatGPT for fun to see what was going to happen, and really nothing came out because it doesn't understand the clinical context. So we've had to take a more customized machine learning approach to then use the clinical data context so that now the machine learning algorithm knows what it's looking at. Because if you use standard off-the-shelf machine learning, it's fine, but it has no idea about our world. And so the more we can teach it and customize it to our world, the better it becomes. And it's learning. It's learning all the time. Every time we're putting data through it, it's learning and learning and learning. Yeah. And then we get to predictive. And that's, I think, where it becomes quite interesting. You know, we've started to look at this. You know, our history as a company has been very much around applying statistical methodologies and some degree of machine learning to what has been traditionally a very on-site process of site monitoring and checking data and trying to determine if there's any fraudulent data activities using manual review processes. We took away those manual review processes and replaced them with statistical methodologies, and have been very successful in helping clients to eliminate a lot of those manual processes they've relied on, which is great. And then we're also now at the point where we're able to start to predict a little bit. We're starting to see those patterns emerge, where you start to see a couple of things happening at the beginning of a trial where it gives you an indication that actually there's some oversight probably required. And it's not just traditional pharmaceutical companies to go and do some site monitoring. That's not it at all. You know, it's also a question to the site to say, look, you know, you haven't looked at this set of patients for a while. We're starting to see something emerging that needs to be looked at, because you are naturally, because they're now covering maybe 6 or 7 remote sites, you're not involved in the way you used to be.
But see, I think this is where there's some really good parallels. It used to be as data managers that we released the database at some point. The paper came in, we got the database ready, off we go. Then EDC came along, and actually the timelines didn't necessarily change. We still start a bit late. And then as you start to do research, you realize a couple of things. First of all, the mistakes made in the first few days, you never get to course correct. The sites get into a muscle memory, and they repeat and they repeat and they repeat. So you have to be ahead of them, which is why I think the prediction comment is very good. The second thing, which kind of we dispelled, is data managers always said, don't worry if we start slow, we always catch up. You never catch up. That's right. The truth.
Yeah.
And I think you're echoing that here and perhaps taking it into another level, which is if you make the mistakes early, if you don't catch them early enough, the reality is you don't make it up.
Yeah.
And they perpetuate through every part of what we're doing. So predictive, I think, is going to be incredibly important. Do you mind if I, and I'm switching around here a little bit, do you mind if we then perhaps talk a little bit about what Clue Points are doing in terms of projects? Mm. So you have, I suppose, kind of an envious position in the sense of relatively new CEO, started in December, shaping a bit of the business, making some decisions. But you have ongoing projects with sponsors, so you're seeing that dimension. Also with some CROs, and also with regulators, which I think is very interesting. Would you mind just talking a little about those three different aspects? Are they one and the same project? Are they very different?
They're quite different. I think a lot of, so let's start with sponsors. So sponsors clearly have particularly the big ones, have a desire to embrace more risk-based approaches. We've all seen ICH E6R3 coming out. There's a lot of momentum now in the business to go, okay, we need to be doing things differently. There's an awareness that this 100% SDV or 70% SDV paradigm needs to shift. It's amazing how many people in the industry still think that that actually works. We know it doesn't work. We've all known for years that SDV doesn't work, so we still had data problems even with 100% SDV. And so people have now realized, okay, we need to get that down. And that's a big change management plan for most sponsor companies to go, I mean, this is just breaking the surface of it, right? But if all we do is to go from 80% SDV down to 15, 20% SDV, or as far as 0% as some of our customers have achieved, that's a huge saving with that alone. Now, at the same time, we're also trying to increase the quality. So it's not just all about saving money with SDV, it's also about increasing the data quality. And that's a big part that we also focus on. And that's a shift you tend to see when you go into the CRO world. So the CRO world, for obvious reasons, I guess, are not so hot on pushing how much they can eliminate SDV by. Yep. But what's really important for their value proposition for their customers is data quality. We all know data quality in our world is absolutely critical. And if the CROs can be using capabilities and processes that ensure data quality for the sponsors, then they're very interested. So we definitely see that paradigm coming in. The regulators have been doing this for a while, right? This is not a new thing. The regulators have had statistical teams who have been working to look at data patterns to try and spot fraudulent data, to spot data issues. And we're very honored the fact that they, you know, the FDA in particular, has adopted Clue Points as its engine to do a lot of the detection work. And they use it in very different ways, but again, it's for them, you know, they are the last and final arbitrator. They are the last place it sits before a drug gets approved based on this data, and they want to check it every which direction. And they're spinning the data around in multiple different ways. And it's, you know, for them, they've got to just reassure themselves that ultimately there is nothing odd going on. And it's still, sadly, problems are still found today. And, you know, we all, as an industry, would love to get to the point where it's a tick box exercise, the regulators to go, yep, okay, it's fine, it's clean, we go. I don't know when that's going to come in the industry, but we're not there yet. We all have that as our constant drive in data management to make that happen.
We do, but I think there's some companies that we're both supporting in our own way at the moment, with some pretty lofty ambitions. The idea of going from last patient, last visit in that last study, not to database lock in 24 hours, but frankly to submission ready in 24 hours, to going through the submission process in a matter of days, to being in the market in 4 days.
Yeah.
That's not a little tweaking of processes.
No.
That's a pretty fundamental side of everything we do.
Yeah.
Do you think that's where our thinking needs to be? Do we get there in one step, or is it a series of stepping stones? And multiple question again. Do you think as an industry we can actually free ourselves up and get out of our own way at times to achieve that? And I'll stop there because I've got more questions, but I suspect I'm throwing too many at one time.
No, it's fine. So I absolutely agree that's where we should be aiming, what we should be aiming to do, and that is probably the ultimate goal, is, you know, how we used to talk about a month between last patient, last visit, and database lock. That has come down. Like I said, submission ready is then a further step, and we should all have the ambition to bring that to hours and days rather than weeks and months. How it's achieved is in part enabled by technology that we all love, but it's a huge amount of change management. What we tend to find with our clients is that there's a bit of a breakdown that occurs. So a lot of the senior management buy into this is what we want to do, and they know how we should do it, and there's alignment at that level. But as it gets right down to the individual study teams who are actually having to make it happen, that's where it, so it's not a question of making multiple steps. To me, it's a question of successful change management and successful processes. You know, customers have achieved it, right? With a lot of heavy lifting and heavy work, they have achieved hours. But I don't necessarily want to repeat it again, but we know it's possible. Now we've got to figure out a way to make sure that we as a business, as an industry, can make that the normal. And it ultimately starts with different ways of working. And I think it's always a challenge in our industry, right? We've been doing things the same way for a number of years. It has, to a degree, we talked about regulators before, been enforced by the regulators or reinforced by the regulators, because they don't like to see things changing and modifying too much unless they really understand what and why. So as we start to see the regulators themselves now being much more proactive to say, look, come on, it's time to change, it's time to do things differently. My sincere hope is that that frees up a lot of the sponsor companies and the CROs to be brave enough to try different ways of working. Because if you do the same way and just try a bit of process and a little, to your point, a little bit here, a little bit there, you're shaving tiny pieces off. It's got to be a big shift in the way of working. And back to your previous point around everything earlier. I mean, we know that, right? We've been around long enough to know you can't catch up. And the only way that you're ever going to get to the point of having a small period of time between last patient, last visit, and submission ready is by doing as much upfront as you can, which requires constant data reviews, requires different processes, more centralization. You know, again, we've been in a very decentralized world for a while, different terminology, but a world where people have been going out to sites and doing lots of activities at the individual site level. The more that's brought into a central team to oversee the data using methodologies and, you know, technologies, the better it is.
So agree. I think a phrase we've been operating this week in is don't let the past inhibit the future.
Right.
But also, as you know, one of the slides I like to use is a vision of Clintrial 3.3, which is very much in my past.
Yeah.
But actually, I think you're still striving for what we could do in the past in a modern world. Now, the challenges, the inputs might be different. I'm not saying they're the same. But you've got to recreate that user experience, the ability for a team in one place, distributed, centralized, whatever phrase we use, to do everything.
Right.
And then I think you can take actions out. One of the things I think I want to explore with you in a second is if we do this well, people do less. And they spend more time actually thinking about the context and thinking about the patient, not the mechanics of did a data source come together? Is it complete? Is it robust? Is it firing when it should fire? They should actually be looking at the data and remembering the patient. That for me is something I've taken away from the last few days. And it, I think, echoes what you're saying there. If you let the past inhibit the future, we're not going to move. It isn't a 1% improvement we're after. It's almost an infinitesimal percentage improvement.
What the industry needs is highest quality data. You know, if you can guarantee me the quality that I need, I don't necessarily need to worry about how many people you're putting behind that. I care about the output. If we can get there, I think we can move a lot quicker in the industry as well.
And I think if we can broaden the data set, do you think we also get to the point where the lessons we're learning now on perhaps a data-driven start to change where we do research, the nature of some of the research projects, it actually goes full circle to then change the future of the data we're collecting and so on. I have a feeling it's ready to go full circle, but again, I've had a number of conversations this week about synthetic arm studies,
yep.
And I kind of have an issue with that because it doesn't feel like any one person is showing me the complete data set. Mm. And I just feel like we're kind of learning a little bit, but then there's a grayness to that data.
And in many instances, a lot of synthetic control data isn't randomized. It's open label. Yeah. And that's the other challenge, is you have a small data set. But yeah, I mean, it's a multi-layered conversation around synthetic arms. So let's start at the macro level. And it's something I've worked in the past in my life. And I like the idea, I like the principles, and I think it has a lot of value. Why in every indication with every drug type are we redoing placebo patients, redoing standard of care patients, when there's data that exists already? So if we can, as an organization or as a industry, get the level of confidence with aggregation and anonymization techniques that we all feel that our data is protected enough that I'm not going to expose my IP, but we as an industry can benefit from some of this control data that's going to mean that I'd have to put patients through standard of care when they think they're on an exciting new drug, and it's like, no, you're on standard of care. You made me on placebo. And if we can get rid of some of that, that'll be amazing.
So let me take that as a segue and get back to AI, ML, NLP potentially. What do you think the future holds? So we've talked a little bit there, one potential future, but if you could talk to the audience and say, this is what you should be doing, or this is what we're not doing enough of. Are there particular things that are driving your agenda, the ClearPoints agenda?
Yeah, I think, well, the Clue Points agenda, we ultimately go after things that we see highly manual activities that we believe we can automate through machine learning and or statistics. And you know where we've gone so far. So we obviously started around monitoring. We're now moving more into data anomaly detection, medical coding, you know, some of these activities that have been very traditional, very labor intensive, and can we find ways of making that faster? So I think, you know, to me, the initial interest point to, again, stop it being hyperbole and everybody getting overexcited about things, just be looking at parts of the industry where a lot of people are doing a lot of heavy lifting on a daily basis, and what can we do to reduce that down? I mean, some of the other conversations, which I know, you know, we've got into this week as well, is take the other process, right, around getting that submission-ready data and getting the right format. And there are people who have to write an awful lot of programs and capabilities to get data into the right structure. Can we use ways of learning what the data structures are to automatically or some way produce the submission data sets transformed using machine learning? You know, there's some other areas to go into. But the feeling from Clue Points right now is that's where we're focused on, is we're not going to go crazy on areas which already are quite automated. We're going after the very manual activities today because that's where machine learning really shines.
I totally agree. I think you started off by saying that certain phrases are being very overused. And I think I observe a lot of use cases, and I just think, actually, that's just smart technology. If you built your product right the first time, you wouldn't need a secondary solution to do that. And I want to bring us back to, I think there are genuine use cases. Now, I think coding is an interesting one you mentioned, because that has a personal connotation on us, which is a good one, by the way, which is you've shone a light on the fact, actually, there's a new way of thinking.
Yeah.
Synonyms are kind of an old world concept. Now, you build it a certain way for a certain expectation, for a certain use case. But now as we think about future investments, we're now clearly thinking, this doesn't feel like it's the right path. So there's another conversation there. But I think that's also maybe leading into a question I'd love to ask you is, what does good technology partnership look like? You know, from where you're working across different sectors with different technology providers, what do you need to make these use cases work? Because I tend to think you're in a fairly unique position. We're not competing.
Right.
So we're looking for you as a partner. So what do you need from us, from others, to accelerate some of the things you're working on?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I think that the coding's a good example, right? It's been a great partnership between Clue Points and Veeva. For those who don't know, and again, it is really ripping up the synonym paradigm. We don't have synonyms anymore. We're moving up to over a 99% accuracy rate on Medra and WHO drug coding using machine learning,
which is versus 65, 70.
We're using synonym lists that the industry's been used to, which is, again, a great achievement. When we're working with technology partners, and in fact, I had this conversation just earlier today at your conference with a customer who was asking me exactly the same question. To me, it starts with alignment on values. And we're excited about partners that we can work with who think like us and have the same drive and desire as us, right? What I care about is a bunch of smart people from two different companies getting together and making impressive stuff happen. And it starts with cultural alignment. I think it's important to make sure that when we are doing these partnerships that we have customers who actually want us to be doing this. I don't think we should be doing this in isolation. And you know, I know that's a big part of the way that Veeva and Clue Points think about things is we want our customers' input. But to me, if you don't have that shared vision and shared core values, and I think it's more important about the core values, you tend to find the technology partnership being less effective. And it's us and them, and then we have all the problems.
Thank you for that. So I've got two final questions.
Sure.
One is really about the future. So coming back to AI, ML, there's a negative conversation, which is the black box concept. Mm-hmm. Now, you've talked a little bit about supervised and non-supervised and so on, but how do you address that concern about what is the black box doing, regulatory perspective and so on? And you've mentioned the FDA are using the black box. So what's your take on when people comment?
Yeah, it's absolutely one of the biggest challenges you come up against when walking customers through what's happening and how is it working is it is machine learning by its very nature is a black box, right? We're not coding rules and algorithms in the way that people are used to seeing. It's a completely different paradigm. Ultimately, again, it comes, the only way you can really unlock the black box will never be unlocked. It's always ultimately a little bit hard for anybody, even the people who are coding it, to really know what the heck this thing's doing at the heart. But you watch it learn and evolve, and ultimately the results are what gives everybody the confidence. So you start to see the results moving in the direction that you need. You go, okay, I don't know how it's doing it, but I'm kind of impressed. Again, you know, I'll come back to the ones that we know and love. Do any of us have any idea how ChatGPT works? No. But you can ask it all sorts of crazy questions, and the answers it gives out are incredibly accurate. And you go, okay, I have no idea how it's working, but what you've just given me is absolutely spot on. And the same with just the basic thing of writing emails on your phone or on email. It's predicting stuff, and sometimes it gets a little bit wrong, but you go, I don't know how it works. And so when we get to that level, it is going to take time, right? It's going to take time for confidence to grow and people's mindsets to change. And we are a technical industry, right? We're used to writing code. We're used to understanding how things work and want to understand how things work. And at some point, we're just going to have to let that go and trust, let the results prove themselves and build the trust with us.
And if I could give you a magic wand and you could make one thing disappear, go to room 101, never to be done again. And if there's one thing you could suddenly make happen, something you can't do today, what would they be?
So there's two questions there, right? So one is the...
Disappear, appear.
Appear. Disappear, I'm going to step outside of clinical data management for a minute. I think that in the industry there's, if you think about a very simple thing that we have, which I know you're all working on as well, but if I think about my Ecoa world and how much time and effort is spent by everybody redoing the same assessments, the same translations over and over again because it's basically required and we can't seem to get around that requirement. If we can make that requirement disappear, this industry will save an awful lot of money and we'll be able to move a lot more. It's one of those things that just grated me for a number of years is, why do we keep having to redo this?
Yep.
We're redoing assessments, instruments, translations every single time. That would be lovely to see that disappear. And it's in human control to make that happen. It's humans discussing whether that's required or not.
100%. That is probably number one on our list. I know the very first conversation I had about the Ecoa world with Peter Gastron, CEO, that's where he went to. That is an outrageous position. So it's number one on our list. We're not going to change it on our own.
No.
But we are ready to put our hands up and find a way to change that for sure.
Yeah, so that's the first thing. On the appearing side, we need even more consolidation on how we are capturing data. So we still have lots of different ways of capturing data through lots of different systems, and the data gets moved around an awful lot, and that creates challenges. So if we can have I hadn't thought about it till just now, but this comes back to the ecosystem conversation, but an ecosystem of capabilities that plug into a common environment where we can now bring information in one way into one place, it's going to help, you know, all the conversations we've had so far today, everything we've talked about, if we can start to address data currency and data movement in a really elegant way and have all the information come into one place and make it available, my life becomes easier, your life becomes easier, our customers' lives become easier, and we just become a lot more agile. Today, we still have so much distributed data, and it is actually getting worse rather than better with new technologies. So I'd like to find a way of fixing that.
I have to completely agree with that as well. Interestingly, Patrick Nadolny and I just literally talked about the 5 Vs.
Mm-hmm.
And what he said is if you put volume, velocity, and variability together, fix that with technology,
mm-hmm.
what that leaves you is veracity,
right,
and value.
Yeah.
Then we can deal with those two.
That's right.
I think it's exactly the same. So we are joining you on that mission as well.
Good.
So thank you for that. Andy, it's been an absolute pleasure. I really do appreciate your time and effort. This has been great. I will just say for our audience, if you have enjoyed this podcast, please do join us and look at the ones we've released previously and hopefully join us for the ones yet to come. But Andy, thank you very much.
Thanks, Richard.
I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.